This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Good morning. It's 4 minutes past 7 o'clock. My name is Arabile Gumede. Welcome to your Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. As usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Nastasia Aronsa.
Good morning. And coming up on the show, we're going to be looking at gold miner Anglo Ashanti, the plans to cut about 2,000 jobs in its local operations. This is as an effort to cut costs. They roughly employ about 8,200 people in the country. So we'll speak to the spokesperson, Chris Ntite.
Yep. And we're also getting to speak to the Auditor General. Of course, he did put out the Municipal Finances Report. We do get a word in with him this morning, just particularly with how municipal finances are doing. We have had really bad news in, with regards to that, only 13% of them receiving a clean audit. And we'll get some other news as well from that report and just what his plans are for the coming year.
Right, and then we have Human Settlements Minister Noma India Mfeketo, and we're going to be talking to her about the so-called title deeds backlog and how that affects her department, particularly considering that her budget has been cut quite tremendously in order to fund the free education plan.
Yeah, keeping with some other mining news that Tash spoke about earlier as well, the Minerals Council of South Africa, which is formerly the Chamber of Mines, held their AGM yesterday. A lot going on in that mining industry, and we'll get really deep within the numbers as well, just how many people are left within South Africa's mining industry that keeps suffering at the hands of dwindling jobs, and at the same time just a fall with regards to production and the deepness of South Africa's mines. All that and a bit more coming up on today's Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Let's get into it.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
These market indicators are brought to you by FNB, bringing you the 48-hour cash accelerator. Visit fnb.co.za for more information. Let's quickly check in on how the local currencies rather are doing. 12.46 for a US dollar. It's been a better day for now, 1.7% to the negative rather. With the pound at 16.65 and a euro will set you back 14 rand and 58 cents. Taking a look then at how the international markets are doing, the Dow Jones futures are down 0.2%. The Dow Jones Industrial, however, closed yesterday 0.2% to the good, 24,886 points. The S&P 500 at 2,733. It was up 0.3%. The NASDAQ at 7,425. That's 0.2% to the good as well. The FTSE 100 yesterday closed at 7,788, 1.3% lower. The DAX in Germany at 12,976, while the CAC 40 was at 5,565. This morning, the Nikkei index is at 22,400. It's down 1.3%. The Shanghai Composite Index as well, and not so long ago, was trading at 3,167 points, with the Hang Seng at 30,686 rather. Onto your commodities, $1,295 a fine ounce for the price of gold, $907 for platinum, while Brent crude is sitting at $79.81 a barrel. These market indicators were brought to you by FNB. Get a great rate and quick access to your investment. T's and C's apply.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
It's just gone 9 minutes after seven, and I'm joined in studio by Bright Kumalo, who is from Vestec Asset Management. Bright, the last time you and I spoke was probably just over 3 weeks ago, and a lot has changed when you look at the global markets or even local markets. We got to a point last week where we thought trade conditions with US and China starting to ease, but now we're back again where it's a point of uncertainty. The only markets that had a positive day were the US markets, and that was on the back of the Fed comments saying that they're willing to let inflation run. But when you look at that overall picture and you look at the things that have changed, what are some of the ones that stick out to you that kind of paint a picture as to why we're here?
Yes, it's lovely to be here this morning chatting to you. Basically, like you're saying, we look at the Asian markets, they're also pretty low today. You know, that's because mostly of those trade concerns you're talking about, they're back in focus again. And this is basically Donald Trump coming back and saying the current trade situation with China is too hard to get done. I don't know what that means, but it's not happy. And like you were saying, we were expecting those to actually ease and, you know, to have a better deal, because that's what U.S. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin was saying on Sunday. That's why everyone on Monday, you know, woke up positive. But it seems like we're back to square one where there's a lot of uncertainty. But we like uncertainty in the markets. You know, it always breeds opportunities. Mm. And, you know, this is not long term. Trump is not here to stay. Any opportunity gives us to buy good companies at cheaper prices, we'll jump at that opportunity. Looking at, you know, the South African markets, we have our own sort of issues. Yesterday, we closed down 1.9%. That's on the back of the quickening inflation number, well, the proxy of inflation, which is CPI, Consumer Price Index. That's about 4.5% for the month of April, up from 3.8% in February, sorry, March. So that's another reason. And basically now about 25 economists that were surveyed by Reuters are saying that we expect the interest rate decisions today by the central bank basically to not do nothing. They don't want to do nothing.
Yeah.
So that cut that everyone was expecting, unfortunately, is not there anymore. So we'll wait for that to come out today around 3 o'clock. Yeah. And tomorrow it's S&P and their rates decisions. With the quickening inflation, I don't think we're on the good side of things here. So, but again, that remains to be seen. But all of these add up basically to a good opportunity if anything had to happen.
What do you think of SA Inc. stocks at this point? Because in the beginning of the year, when there was the euphoria excitement, you know, a lot of analysts you spoke to were excited about certain key stocks because they thought they would benefit from the positive sentiment and the fact that, you know, the economy might actually go in the direction that we all wanted to go. When you look at the JSE markets and what's going on there and some of the particular stocks, what do you make of that entire picture?
So I'll start with the rand against the dollar. Basically, we lost all of our gains since, you know, December. You know, we saw a great run in the rand, but that's mostly the strength of the U.S. dollar and their own interest rate policies and their central bank and now the trade wars. Which is positive for the US, I guess, but not so good for all emerging market currencies. But we're not in the same position, say, for example, Argentina or Turkey, which the Turkish lira has seen, you know, this is the worst time for them. That's fortunate for us because we just lost a couple of points that we had against the US dollar. But coming back again to South Africa and those SA Inc. stocks, you're looking at banking here, you're looking at companies like Bidvest. They haven't given up most of their gains, but again, it's all about business confidence, and we've seen that it's back to where basically pre-Ramaphosa, as they say. So that's it doesn't sound good, but that's mostly again the strengthening dollar and the oil price that we're seeing at all-time highs. We're talking about since 2013. This is insane.
Right. On the sense front, we had CAS Consolidated Infrastructure Group having a trading statement, Taste Holdings, AdCorp providing some clarity on the expected earnings for 2019, and there was Tsogasan and HCI. Which one of those did you get a chance to glance at?
I looked at Tsogasan and I looked at Reinet. Mm-hmm. I'll start with Reinet. Basically, this is the Rupert Rand fund that has most of its investments. I think it's about 61% is British American Tobacco. And a bunch of smaller funds, private equity funds that he invests in. Again, this is a company that's been doing well on the back of that British American Tobacco asset, you know, rallying a lot, but not so recently as we've seen it. It went to £51 and then went all the way down to £38. And that has affected the net asset value at down about 14% to £5.1 billion pounds, which is not good for them. But again, this is a perpetual capital fund, so I wouldn't worry too much if I was Rupert. I still get my fees, you know. I'll take this deal any day.
Yeah.
Give me some cash and buy an asset that gives you 260 million euros, and you pay to your shareholders 36 of that, and you keep the rest. I'd be happy to be in that position. Looking at Tsogo-san, they in the Monte Cassino operations, it's very interesting. Their fortunes there seem to be reversing down 3%, mostly because they said bad luck. I think there's a lot of people that have been reading Ed Thorpe's book, Beat the Dealer. So it's not working out for them there. But as an overall, the company seems to be just bumbling along as compared to their competitor. For example, you say it's Sun International. They're not seeing good fortunes there, but they have their own problems in South America, whereas Tsogo-san is mostly an SA Inc. stock and a bit of offshore, but still here in Africa mostly. Those we saw, Silver Star, all of them seem to be doing just fine. Their gambling wins were about 9.7 billion rands. Yeah. That's a lot of gambling that people, South Africans, do. And, you know, it's very sad when you think about it. Their hotel operations also doing somewhat okay, with about 3 billion rands in terms of their share of the earnings. And the interesting thing I saw there, what HCI was doing is, you know, rejigging or just, you know, reshuffling some of their assets, putting they also hold part of the REIT hospitality. They took their hotel assets, put them into Tsogo-san. I think Tsogo-san is going to do a better job in refurbishing those hotels and running them just generally, which is good for the company, but they had to take a hit in the interim as a result. So lots and lots of stuff. And also the limited payout machines, they moved them from Nivea's to Tsogo-san. So again, Tsogo-san benefiting from having a good parent.
All right, that's Bright Kamalo. He's staying with us. He's from Vestec. He'll be with us throughout the show. All right, it's over to you with the Audit General.
Yeah, only a massive underwhelming 13% of municipalities, that's around 33 of the 257, received a clean audit in the last financial year. Only 16 municipalities improving as well. Auditor General Kimi Makwetu joining us on the line this morning. Auditor General, thank you so much for your time. A sad picture painted from you yesterday, but it all seems to have stayed the same or even gotten worse in some areas. Do you believe that government is even listening to you through these reports?
Good morning, Arabile. Arabile, I think what we're reporting in this report this year is the fact that the management of finances, as you know, all of the nine provinces have got a spread of municipalities. And what we are picking up in these reports is the fact that financial management disciplines are falling apart. No one is taking a clear responsibility in a number of these municipalities. Because we have raised these matters before, and I'm sure you probably have got a 5 to 10 year history of similar issues. There have been improvements in the past, but some of those have also regressed. So it's really a situation where if there is no strong accountability by mayors and councillors, we are going to find that the services that are required to be delivered do not get to those people because the money sometimes is not accounted for.
Yeah. You've also suggested amendments, perhaps, and they've been, you know, there's a set of amendments that will be published soon as well to the Auditor General Act. These would probably allow you to report wrongdoing to the Hawks, that allow you to hold government officials liable when money is misappropriated. Would those be sufficient to your office?
You know, what we are banking on, Arabile, like any other thing that is tightened in legislation, it also depends on the effectiveness with which it will be implemented. Now, for a discipline like that to really find root, it requires a strong tone at the top in those institutions so that if an accounting officer and the CFO know that when an audit starts, it will end with some consequences where there is significant wrongdoing identified. I think it will help us in the journey towards discouraging many people from ignoring the basic stuff. And that's what we really are banking on. And again, even if we have that power, what will ultimately work will be when those that are charged with the responsibility to effect it do as the law prescribes.
Yeah.
So we still have a journey ahead, but I think what is good about it is that you are no longer going to just walk away from an irregular expenditure that is brought to your attention. You're going to have to do something about it. And what this power says is that that something is not just going to be the persuasion that we are used to in respect of the follow-up on previous year audit findings, but it's going to be about going to the depth of those transactions to identify who the responsible party is. And that's what I think will be a better tool than we have now, where we report, persuade, and there's a greater chance that we can be ignored because they know there are no consequences later on.
Indeed. Auditor General, I'm going to ask a very quick favor if we can just take traffic very, very quickly and hopefully get back to the interview and just chat just a little bit more with regards to this change as well, the Auditor General Act, and how that may affect capacity at your office. Kimmy Makwetu joining us perhaps just after this traffic. Well, still joined by Kimmy Makwetu, the Auditor General of South Africa, as we take a look at South Africa's municipal finances. Auditor General, thank you again for staying on the line. We were just speaking about, you know, those changes to the Auditor General Act, allowing you to hold government officials liable when money is misappropriated, being able to report wrongdoing to the hawks and the like. And you had said that being able to stand accountable is going to be quite significant. The question, however, to that then becomes, do you have enough personnel to deal with that requirement? Do you have the capacity for that change in the Act?
Let me just clarify up front, Arabile. An audit process will continue to be the audit process that we are used to. But what will be an additional challenge for our staff across all these audits will be the vigilance to identify critical material irregularities while they are auditing. So it is not a task over and above what they were doing, barring perhaps maybe an additional 10% of reporting responsibilities once the audit is completed.
Yeah.
Because we still are reporting those matters anyway during the course of a normal audit under the current regime. So what we are tightening is the final, if you call it, the evaluation and conclusion stage of the audit, where we then identify those matters that are likely to lead to financial loss. So it doesn't really require a huge recruitment process. It just requires a realignment, largely, of the same people who are trained in this discipline to even be more vigorous in identifying those matters, because they carry now the responsibility to report on them. And they will have to account for situations where, if they were meant to have identified something significant, they will have to account for why they didn't bring it up if it ends up coming out elsewhere.
Yeah. If in that process, then, it would mean that you'd need to have stronger sort of audit partners. Is that a shift or perhaps, you know, a key element then for the Auditor General moving forward, that your partners perhaps are also the ones that you'll be looking at strongly with regards to how they perform their duties?
No, certainly we're going to have to engage them as soon as these powers. If you're talking about our partners, if you're talking about the firms that we use in the private sector, is that what you mean?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, no, certainly, certainly. It will definitely need us to interact with them. And in fact, we have planned, once the review of the powers has been completed, to also update them through our public audit manual. We normally issue a public audit manual, which is a set of instructions as to the scope of work that is required to be done. So that will also incorporate that. For example, it will have things like a specific memorandum required on any material irregularities identified, which are required to be followed up, whereas currently we don't worry about that. So we will definitely need them to gear up. But as I say, where there will be additional resources, it will possibly be resources that will become necessary as a result of the new powers. And I don't think that it's something major. It's probably just a unit of people who will then be responsible for processing of those issues and clear them legally and otherwise.
Yeah. You have called for urgent government intervention with regards to municipalities. What sort of intervention are you suggesting?
A lot of it is already on the go. If you listened to Minister of COGTA yesterday, they've already put together the likes of National Treasury and COGTA, and have identified somewhere around 73 municipalities where they have made specific intervention to look at things like their capacity within the finance department. Because if you think about it also, Arabia, some of these things, they fall out because the basic stuff, you know, when it deals with issues of debit and credit, the good thing about it is that there's no third way.
Yes.
There are only two ways that you can account for a transaction. It's either the one side goes to the debit, but there's got to be a corresponding credit going elsewhere.
Indeed.
Now, those things are not supposed to be rocket science in essence, really. You just have to think about what you're doing and keep the record to substantiate it, because mostly auditors are there to substantiate things that you claim have happened, as well as to look for those things that ought to have happened, which has not been surfaced in the accounting records.
Yeah.
And that's where the trick comes, because sometimes you also don't know, and you are none the wiser as you are asking the question, or rather as you are being asked the question by the auditor.
Yes.
So you need to get people who understand what they are doing and are able to ask those questions of the people inside the institution who are responsible for dispersing the work, as well as supervising the programs that they are implementing. And those are the basic disciplines.
AG, before I let you go, very, very quickly, I need to ask that, considering recent events, do the likes of, you know, the likes of Nkonki, do the likes of KPMG, do small audit firms actually still have a place with regards to the AG's sort of ecosystem in future? Are you just hoping that, you know, certain things will change and then perhaps they can get back to having some sort of business with the Auditor General?
Arabile, we have a database of private audit firms, those people who trade on their own account as auditors. A database that is close to about 90 different firms, 90. It ranges from Dungwa and Company to PwC in terms of the spread of firms. So we still have a strong capacity of those many 4,500 registered auditors that exist in South Africa. So it's not just concentrated around a few firms. There's quite a number of them that still participate in the work that we do. But what is important for all of them is that because of the seriousness of the mandate that we carry as an institution, we always jealously guarding the issue of carrying out this work with the appropriate level of independence, as well as with the level of professional competence and ethics that are required to be able to continue to have trust in the reports that are issued to the public. And that is the minimum that we're looking for as an audit office. So if anyone has got those particular foundations in place, we are in business.
Auditor General Kimi Magwetu joining us on the line. Thank you so, so much for your time, having released that municipal finances report yesterday. Only about 13% or so of municipalities getting a clean audit.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
It's 7:31. Time to talk about Anglo Gold. They announced yesterday that they planned to cut 2,000 jobs in their local operations as part of plans to cut costs. They employ roughly about 8,200 people in the country. And they operate in an environment where a lot of the mining companies have saw difficulty when it comes to a risk of volatile labor relations, rising costs, regulatory disruptions and technical issues. But to talk to us about the restructuring plans is Chris Ntite, who is the spokesperson for Anglo Gold. Chris, thank you so much for your time. Let's start off with when the communication or the signaling to stakeholders began about the plans to start restructuring the asset portfolio in the country.
Yeah, the signal was sent out last year around June, where we indicated to stakeholders that we need to restructure our South African operations as some of the assets were mature and they've reached the end of their lives. And we did signal when we announced this that following the restructuring of the operations, we will have to look at the support services that are provided to the mines. By support services, I mean HR, finance, mining and engineering services, as well as IT support, to ensure that with the smaller production base in South Africa, because following that restructuring, our assets in South Africa have been cut by half.
Mm-hmm.
We are now left with the Mponeng underground mine as well as a surface operation, which is a smaller production base, and we need to match that support service with our smaller footprint.
Right. I can imagine this is not an easy decision to make, and it's a very difficult decision to be able to let employees go. However, yesterday at the Chamber's AGM, the Minerals Minister, Gwede Mantashe, mentioned that he wants mining companies to explain their decisions in order to that they make for closing mines. So he basically, you know, used the term phrased as use it or lose it principle. What do you hope that this engagement between the, you know, the ministry and yourselves will be going forward in terms of how do you mitigate the pressures you're going through, but also, you know, take into consideration the employees that you have to let go?
Yeah, well, this is a difficult decision for us, but more so for our colleagues that are affected, because this really affects the livelihoods of many people in our country. And we do take into account the state of the economy as well as the difficult job market. However, we need to balance the need for employment as well as the sustainability of the business. Mm. Because if we do not address the oversized footprint in our SA business, that risks the overall sustainability of the two long-term operations that we are left with, as well as the jobs that go with it. Mm. So we will proceed with this conversation with our employees, organized labor, as well as the regulators, including the DMR, to mitigate these job losses to the greatest extent possible. Because we did demonstrate last year when we announced, when we signaled to stakeholders that we need to restructure our South African operations. The number that we put forward was about 8,500. And through a series of measures, such as voluntary severance packages, early retirement, voluntary early retirement, asset sale, as well as transfers within the other business units in the company, we're able to reduce the number of retrenchments to about 2,700 from 8,500.
Right, Chris.
So, and we are looking forward to this consultation where we will share our plans and assumptions with all the stakeholders, and we will approach this with an open mind.
All right, Chris, thanks so much for your time. That's Chris Sentite, who's the spokesperson of AngloGold, talking about the mining company's plans to restructure.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
As I was saying, still in the world of mining, of course, Tesh did allude to it, but the Chamber of Mines, now called the Minerals Council South Africa, did hold its AGM yesterday in Xolisi Jogo Gojo, who is the president of the Minerals Council South Africa, does join us on the line. Xolisi, thank you so much for your time, President. It's no longer a surprise. The industry itself is bleeding jobs. But can we save this mining sector? Can we stop the bleeding?
Thank you very much, Aribela, and for inviting me to your program. I think that the chamber, as we were called before, now being called the Mineral Resources Council, really, our view is that, you know, we have had a long history contributing to the South African economy. And we recognize this history in itself has not really been without its flaws with negative associations. And to that extent, you know, our history, we say that we need to ensure that we have to be part of the solution of creating the future, a future that is going to ensure that our economy grows, a future that ensures that transformation takes place. And really, therefore, our overriding objective is really to press the reboot button with all our key stakeholders. And we want to work together to build a positive policy, regulatory, investment, innovative, and operating environment.
Yeah.
We really envisage a growing, vibrant economy that is supported by mining, contributing really to realizing the national development plan of fighting of a vision of a higher and a more inclusive economic growth.
Yeah, but President, one thing that has probably gone counter to that is the fact that the industry had 380,000 people in its employ in 1995. It's now sitting at less than 116,000. The question becomes then, is regulation the one way to bring it back in terms of stability and the like as well, in order to bring back those jobs?
Yes, as I was indicating earlier on, you know, part of that is really creating a positive policy and regulatory environment where investment, where we can drive innovation, where we can actually ensure that we create a vibrant sector that will actually create new opportunities, new jobs, attract foreign investment. But to be able to do that, you do require a policy and regulatory certainty. But over and above that, we as a nation have to also accept and understand that there are a lot of disparities in our society. There's inequality, there's high unemployment. And therefore, it requires a national vision, first of all, a country vision of what South Africa can be in the future. And underlying that, then we are able to say, as an industry, as a mining industry, how do we support that vision? Because it's going to require various state organs coming together. It's going to require what our role is going to be with the DMR on our side. And it's going to also have to promote things that are going to enable our industry to be globally competitive. And therefore, things like the fourth industrial revolution has got to be part of how we deal with that, which will also promote things of safety.
Yes.
By utilizing new technologies, and therefore the whole issue around safety of workers, but at the same time ensuring that we're also driving transformation. If we are not impactful as an industry in the communities where we are at, where continuously we are unable to create new opportunities for those communities, then we would have failed as an industry. We would have failed as a country, because we have to find a way to actually collectively dealing with the high unemployment issue.
Yeah.
And therefore, this is beyond just the industry in itself, as I have indicated.
Yes.
Hence why we are very much wanting to support the YES initiative, because it addresses those initiatives.
Yes.
Hence why we want to say, as the president is going out there in terms of this huge drive with regard to attracting foreign investment, how do we ensure that our own industry has been structured in a way in terms of policies and regulations that will support that investment coming into our specific industry? Now, we cannot do that on our own. We need
Indeed.
To work with the DMR.
Yeah.
We need to work with other key stakeholders to enable that.
As you said, very, very significant how your relationship with the Mines Minister goes as well. Nkolisi Gojo, who is the President of the Minerals Council South Africa, formerly the Chamber of Mines, joining us on the line there after they held their AGM yesterday. It's a little late, but let's get into your traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
Welcome back to Classic Business Breakfast. It's just gone 17 minutes before the top of the hour. In terms of hot news today that I'm looking at, Tiger Brands came out with their numbers today. Revenue down 4%. Profit margin expands to about 80 basis points, about 33.3%. But the thing they touch on is the rehabilitation work that continues at their value-added meat products. And they're saying that the related costs amount to about 365 million net of initial insurance claims. And I know Bright was having a look at that while you were having your discussion with the Chamber of Mines. Bright, not pretty numbers here. They just look bleak.
Of course. So the big problem at Tiger Brands mainly is the volume numbers actually didn't change. It basically the same as last year. This is their first quarter numbers, right? First half numbers. So if the volumes are not changing, you're not going to really do much. But I see that management has done an exceptional job in terms of controlling costs. Like you're saying, the profit margins haven't actually worsened, actually strengthened by 80 basis points. This is very impressive, considering the current operating economic environment, what's changing in the fast-moving consumer goods space with, you know, the likes of Pick n Pay, ShopRite, you know, building more and more space for their own in-house produced products. So their no-name brands, you know, adopting that Walmart strategy, basically, and pushing out more and more of those fast-moving consumer goods companies, because those are their customers, right? And if your customers are not buying your product, you can see it's actually affected and it's reflected in the volumes. But now talking about the VAMP, that's your value-added meat products. Again, we've spoken about this. I told you they should have, acted with certainty, showing a sense of responsibilities, surprise and shock, and just taking all the products initially, not now, initially from or their gondola ends and all that stuff in your ShopRites and the likes. But they didn't do that. They came out and denied, and that sort of affects the brand, right? So it's really bad how management actually handled that. A good study when it comes to that is a company called Tylenol. They had their own defects in their products. Basically, they took out all of their products, even the products that were not even affected. And they did checks, and apparently that has helped them actually keep that brand strength. And people still use Tylenol products. They've seen all-time volumes now. They're making more money today than they did for shareholders before. So there's a way about these things, I guess.
Yeah. Ara, you have something?
Yeah, indeed. Well, if we thought that the KPMG saga was over, it certainly isn't. Goldfields now is the latest company to say, well, we are approaching the end of our 10-year contract with them, and we will not be renewing it. And certainly we are looking out for a new external auditor to bring to tender. So clearly, the KPMG story continues. As we said also, that the AG's powers may indeed just alter a little bit with regards to who he reports to. So that might certainly help.
All right. We've got Chris Gilmore on the line, and that's because he's written an opinion piece looking at the construction firms, and they're continuing to experience extremely tough conditions, and there's not enough work to sustain it, and no new large-scale products are on the horizon. Chris, thanks so much for your time. I mean, you raised some very valid points and some of the worrying signs that we're seeing on the construction side. But with all this ramophoria, or whatever you want to describe it as, is that, starting to trickle or even translate into an increase in the order books of the construction companies?
Good morning, Tash. No, not yet. Not in the private sector and not in the public sector. You know, in the public sector, as I said in the article, we've had these strange stories for years and years now about all this wonderful infrastructure boom, 800 billion rands and more. Well, it all really resides in how you define infrastructure. But actual bricks and mortar and other things on the ground, we haven't seen anything like that, and it's an absolute nonsense. And as far as the private sector is concerned, yes, I think, you know, they were very highly infused by what happened at the elective conference in December. But I think they need to be more comfortable with what's actually going on the ground before they start committing big money into big projects. So as things currently stand, you know, most of the construction companies, they're rooting around, they're trying to make ends meet with a whole host of relatively small projects. The big projects I mentioned in the report, you know, Santon's annihilation and resurrection that's taken place over the past few years, that's largely coming to an end now. And you can see that there's quite a lot of office space going empty in Santon. And one of the interesting things is, for years and years, people have talked about the retail boom coming to an end as far as malls are concerned. And I think now, at long last, we may be starting to see that. So, you know, the portents at this point in time are really not good.
And you have one of the traditional players that is bucking the trend, and that's WBHO. Just quickly give me a couple of reasons, or one reason, as to why they are doing things slightly different.
I think basically they manage their projects so much better than anybody else. You know, they realize that on the ground you have to get the buy-in of the local community. They do things awfully well. The institutional memory is probably better than any other set of construction companies on the ground. And even in the good times, they manage things properly. So in Australia, for example, there's plenty of infrastructure work. They're guarding against being greedy there, because if you take on too much and things turn around, then it can really turn around and bite you. So as I say, their innate ability to manage projects in good or bad times, I think, is vastly better than any other construction company.
All right, that's Chris Gilmore, who's an independent analyst, talking to us about what the construction firms are doing, particularly WBHO.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
Well, it's just it's around 10 to the hour, 10 to 8 o'clock, that is. But here's an interesting one for you now this morning. Nobody can deny that it's been perhaps a big success story, particularly since 1994. Over 4 million houses built for the disadvantaged and the poor in the country. But at least 1 million people do not have registered title deeds for their homes that they already live in. On the line, we have the Minister of Human Settlements, Nomaindi Mfeketo. Minister, thank you so much for your time. Your predecessors have tried, and now it's your turn to give it a bash. Why is it so difficult to clear this title deed backlog for government-supplied low-cost houses?
Now, good morning, and thank you very much. Good morning to your listeners, too. Well, there are many things. Part of it is, you know, before the human settlement approach, people would invade land and there would be lots of people. Now you need to resettle. The priority for those who are resettling, building houses and resettling people, being municipalities and or provincial government, would be to house people in those RDP houses because they are there already. So I think that's the reason why when you give a person a house, you don't give them title deeds. But I was saying earlier, you know, title deed is just one part of the whole things that we want to do. Title deed, we must realize, doesn't necessarily house people. So, yes, we want everybody who's given a house to have title deed because it symbolizes you are entitled to that house. And what we see in many cases is this moving target of delivering houses, you'll find that you are not sure if the hundreds of people who are living in a particular area, those are the benefits. You know, real beneficiaries that we gave houses, the houses are with other people already. So what I'm trying to say is, yes, it's important, but it's just something to make sure that I've given you a house. And but there's that also has been overtaken by the whole approach we have on human settlements, which is now you need to reverse that apartheid special planning, you need to house people in well-located land so that part of housing people is also in economic development, being to the in the center of opportunities to grow.
The one thing is that it probably may just be about pride as well. It may just be about human nature and human ability to know that you actually have a piece of paper saying that you own something. That in itself is probably very key. Do we even know the people who are supposed to receive these title deeds? Is there some sort of database at the very least, at least then, that we can get that process going?
This line is a bit bad. Definitely, there would be a list. If housing people was done properly, which I have no reason to say it's not done properly, you would know, you would have a list of beneficiaries that in each and every municipality, the settlement is planned. So you would have a list of beneficiaries. But I think the issue is it takes long to just make that paper for whatever reason, to have that paper called this is my title deed. So by the time you go back later, maybe things have shifted, that person has sold the house, because we have those things, again, sold the house to somebody else. which by the time the title deed goes, it doesn't necessarily mean the title deeds are not there. But at times, by the time you go back to that area and look for people so that you can hand over title deeds, it's a different person who stays in the house because the house has been sold.
Minister, before we let you go, I just wanted to talk about some of the plans that you have in probably getting a private sector to help you in order to, one, establish a database, but also to help you meet your target when it comes to being able to give as many title deeds as you can. What are your plans?
Well, you know, not only for title deeds. We're still in a process of making sure that with the budget cuts that we have, in the process of making sure that the private sector join hands with us so that we can house South Africans who are unable to house themselves. So surely, with, you know, different forms of building houses that are part of human settlement now, different entities that we have that interact and work with private sector, we're hoping that we'll turn the corner soon, not only around title deeds, but around building different model of houses where, you know, different income groups would be housed, and at the same time assist us with making sure that by the time, if it's your house, by the time you are given a key, the title deed is also available.
Yeah. Minister, your budget has also been cut by 10 billion over a 3-year period in order to pay for tertiary education. Do you still think you can do the tasks that you need successfully despite this very quickly?
Well, it's the government, it's our fiscus that has been cut. Well, we have a mandate to house South Africans that are not able to house themselves. It's a task that must be done. We need to be creative. We need to find ways of making sure that we partner with different, not only the private sector, but also we are responsible for mining companies when they are a private sector. Mining companies doing students housing. So those people must come to the party and also contribute in housing those that, you know, they use to get their profit.
Minister Noma India Mfeketo, the Human Settlements Minister, joining us on the line today as we talk housing. It was called the Reconstruction and Development Program, now called Breaking New Ground. Thank you so much for your time, Minister, and hopefully we can get the tasks that are required with over 1 million people still requiring or needing their registered title deeds. It is 7:58. Michael Avery joining us on the line. You're back this evening, Michael. It's good to have you back. What's coming up?
Well, it's good to be back, Arabile, and I hope the line stays connected this morning. But what we're going to be having a look at ahead of Africa Day tomorrow, because it's Africa Day on the 25th, is the African Continental Free Trade Area. It's absolutely massive. If you look at the numbers, it's going to cover a market of 1.2 billion people, so roughly the size of India or slightly smaller than China, a GDP of $2.5 trillion, and we're going to be asking what's been achieved in the negotiations so far, and how is this going to benefit SMEs, which are really the key to growth in Africa. A lot of interesting results out today. Lawrence McDougall, Tiger Brand CEO, has probably one of the toughest jobs in the country right now, so I'll be sitting down and speaking to him about listeriosis and how they're still responding. We've got Andries van Heerden, who is I think rapidly developing a reputation as a deal maker with the Midas Touch. He's the CEO of Afrimat. And then retailers, as we know, have all taken a beating recently, but PSG has stood relatively firm. So the CFO, Anthony Sundstrom, talked to me about how they've done that, and also his battle with the National Trade Regulator. And we've got the grandfather, Bernie Sanson, who returns from his travels, and he's got his saddlebags bulging, and no guessing for who was the brains behind the rebranding of the Chamber of Mines to the Mineral Council. It was of our own journey sounds. So, as you say, good to be back.
All right, that's Michael Avery from Classic Business giving us an update as to what we can expect later on. Thank you to our studio guest, Bright Kamala from Vestec Asset Management. He was with us during the entire hour, and great conversations.
Yeah, some great stuff coming out of today's show as well. Just remember that 3 p.m. is the time the Reserve Bank Governor, Lesetša Ganyaho, is announcing the interest rates decision today. It is expected to be held at the current rate, stable, so to speak, perhaps even for the remainder of the year as well. How it goes from here, we'll certainly see. But thank you so much. It's been great, and we'll see you again tomorrow.
Goodbye.